Okay, let us begin. I want to answer two questions before I continue, and then maybe a couple of things relevant to what we did last class, and pick up with the stipler, who we've been doing the last two classes. We're going to do him today as well, and we might finish him, I'm not sure. I just want to get back to something we spoke about last class, which has nothing to do with anything we've been doing, but I do like to return to certain issues if people are interested in them. We spoke about the question of opening a refrigerator when the light goes on Shabbos, and I told you what Rav Avadi's position is, that this is not a psik resha de lo nichale, that is not something that happens automatically, that that you benefit from, and we are trying to figure out why don't you benefit. I actually found that Rav Mazuz, who I've quoted so often, discusses it in the Rabbinic Journal Or Torah. If anyone's interested, it's an Elul Tavshin Ayin, and he says simply that, and this is why you can have a minor open it for you, where Havadi had the radical position that you could open it yourself. He says because every previous week you would take out the lights, you would turn off the lights. So that shows you don't really value it, having it on. So that's interesting. I want to respond to Shlomo, who asked me last semester, right at the end, we were speaking about sermons, and I spoke about one of the novelties in America, or in modern times actually, beginning in Germany, is the sermon, this model sermon we have. And Shlomo writes to me how the Noda Yehuda and Rabbi Yonason Eibschitz gave sermons, and that's true, by the way, although many rabbinic contracts only required the Rav to speak twice a year, or at special occasions, like someone important dies. We know that, and some rabbis, by the way, that's all they ever did. I know that in some places they want them to only do that. But the fact is that the Noda Yehuda and others spoke much more than that. And they gave Musser, they rebuked the congregation. But to see the difference between the sermons, just take out any traditional book of sermons, and at the same time, take out the RCA sermon manual that they published for about 20 years. There's a big difference between giving Musser and edification and trying to inspire people to live better lives. Giving Musser, Eva says we're frozen. If anyone else says we're frozen, let me know. It could just be maybe your computer, Eva. But they'll tell me. Tech support will tell me if it's frozen. It's okay. Take a look at the volume of sermons of these rabbis, and there's plenty of Talmudic discussions and everything, so you get to the Musar in the end, you go through lots of other stuff, and it's very, very different. These are not sermons of the sort we think about. Having said that, rabbis who gave sermons did rebuke the community. That's what they were paid to do, to rebuke the community. If they didn't do it, you had special magidim. I did find one sermon. It's actually an amazing sermon. I'm going to write about it on the Sfarim blog. I have a new post coming out maybe tomorrow, the next day, and then I'll write about it maybe for the next one. There's a Rav in the 18th century. He says something amazing. And he publishes this. He says, you community, you know, I know I'm supposed to get up and give you Musser, because after all, there's always ways people can improve, but he says that you are so good in every single way, there's nothing I can tell you to do any better. That is quite unique. The typical, as I said, is to give them Musser, although look at our communities. That's also a big difference, Shlomo. Our rabbis don't give Musser. They don't get up and rebuke the congregation. If you want to see Musser, you mentioned the Noda Yehuda, when they get up and they rebuke the congregation, tell them how bad they are. Any rabbi who does that in our shuls, we're going to fire him. In yeshivas, the Rosh Yeshiva or the Mashgiach can get up and rebuke them, but our rabbis can only lightly nudge you about how it's important to come to Minyan, and then if they're smart, they'll say, I'm also speaking about myself, and, you know, in terms of maybe devote more time to this or that. We do not have anything like the rebukes that Darshanim would get up and literally rebuke the community, to tell them how bad they were being, and the community expected it. We shouldn't be surprised. Look in the prophets. What does Isaiah do? What does Jeremiah? They rebuke the people. They tell them off. And yet, if you look at it, they're sort of like rock stars. People, they follow them around. They have an entourage. Now, why do people, would people want to follow around someone who's going to constantly rebuke them and tell them how bad they are? Because if you're of the mindset that you want to hear how bad you are to improve yourself, then you can accept that. I don't think certainly in modern Orthodox synagogues in 21st century America, we want our rabbis rebuking us. But in more traditional synagogues, maybe you would. So really, there's a very big difference between the new type of preaching that comes in 19th century Germany, first in the non-Orthodox, then in the Orthodox, what we call today homiletics or anything, something like that. It's very different than the traditional drosha. Clarified that. I now, before we start, one of you was very interested in Rav Yosef Yoizel Horowitz, who we spoke a good deal about because I mentioned that when we spoke about how the Sipor went to Navardic. And I think I wasn't clear, perhaps the Sipor did go to Navardic. He didn't go to any of these satellite yeshivas, although there were satellite yeshivas soon to be open. However, the Navardic yeshiva at the time he went to it was not in Navardic. It had moved to Hummel in the Ukraine. And shortly after he came there, they opened up a couple of new branches, and the explosion of branches, the 20 or so branches that I mentioned, happened right after World War I. But I'll just say, those who can read Hebrew and are interested in this fascinating personality, the book Polmos HaMusar, you can see it, and also Tznuat HaMusar of Rabbi Dov Katz. One of you wanted me to say something about this business of him living alone. Now, in this little hut, what happened is, just briefly, he was married, he had children. In fact, one of the Rav Avraham Yaffin, who takes over one of the branches in the Navardic Yeshiva, he was a son-in-law. He had, if I'm not mistaken, two other son-in-laws. One's name was Shmulevitz. No relation, as far as I know, to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, or maybe. His name was, I believe, Alter Shmulevitz, and then there was another son-in-law. I don't believe, he had no sons, and I think he just had three daughters. As far as I know, he had no sons, so offhand. His wife died in childbirth. He's the father. Okay, thank you, Shlomo. That is, this Shmulevitz was the father of Chaim Shmulevitz, who marries into the Mir family and becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva in Israel. In the 1880s, his wife dies. Rav Yoizel's wife dies. And after that, he becomes a hermit for about a year and a half. He lives in this hut. He wouldn't talk to anyone. He would pass messages through a hole if he needed something. And that's where they would bring him his food. One hole, they called him a Baal HaChuriyim. Not Chur. I don't know if the plural is, today we say Hurim, but they called him the Baal HaChuriyim, the master of the holes, because one hole was for Fleshig, one hole was for Milchik, and the Orthodox world thought this was strange. The students of the Alter Sobotka thought this was crazy, but the Maskilim, this gave the Maskilim a chance to really focus on what they thought was all bad about Musar. And you can read about it, as I said, in Pumos HaMusar. However, now let me tell you about something before we move on to the Sipor that hasn't been recorded in any of the literature, and I think is really interesting. It's not a tradition. It's stated by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. It appears, I can give anyone the exact reference if they want. In one of his, Rav Tzvi Yehuda gave Sichot. And these were all recorded. He spoke Saturday night. Other times, they were not Musar Shmuzes, but they're his talks, and he would include a lot of history. When he was young, they used to go with his father to the Baltic Sea. There was resorts that great rabbis used to go to. And he tells a story about one time he's there, and you know who's at the resort? Rav Aaron Balkin, who was the Rav of Pinsk, and Rav Yosef Yoizel. And he describes how both of them were overweight. And he even says that one of the Navardikers didn't like when he described Rav Yosef Yoizel this way. I'm not sure. Maybe because they're an ascetic group, and if he's overweight, it shows he's eating. In any event, he talked, and we know what the where Balkin looks like. I even published a picture on one of my Svarimbank posts. He was overweight. He was unfortunately killed, martyred in the Holocaust. He was a short-lived successor to Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg in Pilvishok in Lithuania, and then becomes the Rav of Pinsk, and he had a son in America, Rabbi Shmuel Balkin, who I believe he made it through Shanghai. And there's a whole family of Balkins, but he was a rabbi in America, in Queens or Brooklyn, I'm not sure. But he was an American rabbi from the into the 1960s, maybe into the 1970s. He is known because is anyone old enough to remember the controversy over the Zim ship lines? He gave the hashkacha to Zim ship lines. And that's where, they on Shabbos, there was a chil Shabbos on the ship, and Rabbi Soloveitchik declared that you shouldn't go on them. So it was a whole big thing. But Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda describes how he witnessed himself, he himself witnessed Rav Aharon Valkin and Rav Yosef Yoizel used to wrestle as a way of exercise. They would wrestle with each other. And that's not recorded in any of the biographies, but that comes from Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Okay, let us now pick up where we left off last class. I was in the midst of something very problematic. I mentioned it's something that you will not find in Art Scroll. You will not find in any of the English books or discussions about the Stipwer, because the Stipwer does have a reputation as a saint. He was a saintly figure, and we are interested in understanding him in his totality, so we don't leave things out. We're going to examine everything. However, we understand Art Scroll, and you know they have a different approach. They don't want to deal with these problematic things, but we're going to deal with them right now. When we started dealing with them, and it is a problem. It raises all sorts of questions. What do you do when someone you admire and esteem, and in so many ways has so much to say and is so positive, but certain things he says you just find it really abhorrent? Not just you, but the leaders of your community. It's an old question, and I don't think we've found the answer. I think in general our assumption is that we take the good, and what's bad we don't take, or what we think is bad, and because you're never going to agree with someone 100%. Sometimes certain figures just become they fall off, the cliff. They just become too extreme, and you can't even use them at all as part of your Weltanschauung, but that's the situation. We ended last class, and I was talking about how the Stipwer was really an anti-Zionist, going so far to say that it's better for Jews, even in the Soviet Union, not to come to the State of Israel. And I said that I'm not sure whether he still would have held this position later on. We don't know what year he's saying this. By the 1970s, certainly the late 70s, you have more Torah being studied in the State of Israel than anywhere else, supported by the government. There was a cultural change in the State of Israel when Menachem Begin is elected. This book, which is recorded, this was published after the Stipwer died, so you would think that the person who wrote it would have clarified this, but not necessarily. Maybe they don't care. But that's what he said. I'll go further and tell you something else. The typical Haredi leader drops all distinctions between the religious and the secular when it comes to wartime. We all know that when there's wartime, we're all united together. And I've been in America during wartime. I've been in Israel during quasi-wartime. And you see it, everyone is united. People standing around listening to the radio, irreligious, orthodox, and what I've been impressed with in the bad times of Israel, I've never actually been there. During what we call a hot war, but I've been there during difficult times, is that you don't get a sense from, at least I never got a sense from the secular negativity towards the Haredi. You have plenty of that at other times. I didn't get a sense, you know, you're not focused on that then, you're united. In this, the Stipwer stands apart, I have to say. And I have to say, I mean, from my standpoint, unfortunately, and this is one of the things I'm talking about. Even in such a traumatic time in which Jewish blood was being spilled, he would not embrace Jewish unity in a way that so many of the other Haredi leaders did, in a way which is standard for American Haredi leaders, and I would say even pretty standard for Haredi leaders in Israel. We see this by how he replied when he was asked during the Yom Kippur War if Tehillim should be recited for the soldiers. Remember what I said last class? He actually thought that the Yom Kippur War was engineered, it was instigated by the Israeli government. I don't know what that means, instigated. Maybe you would say they knew it was coming, they didn't do anything, sort of like people who make the accusation that Franklin Roosevelt knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be bombed, but he wanted to get America into the war. I mean, the Stipwer is quoted as saying that this was a ploy by the Labor government to bring support to itself. He was asked about saying prayers for the soldiers. This is always a problem. To this Shabbos, in most of our synagogues and the people listening, we will obviously say the prayer for the state of it. Many of us will say the prayer for the State of Israel. I understand why that's problematic. It has that section that it's Reishit Tzivcha Gulatenu, it's the beginning of the redemption. You can be a perfectly good Zionist and not believe that line. Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't believe that line. Some shuls now substitute that it should be the beginning of the redemption. We can understand that. However, when it comes to saying the prayer for the soldiers, this also is not done in any Haredi minyan, or I should say almost any Haredi minyan. And it's very hard to understand. These are the soldiers that protect the Haredim. The Haredim could not live. They'd all be exterminated if the Arab masses came in, and yet they're being protected by these soldiers. And there's no Zionist element here in the fact that you could say the beginning of the redemption. It's simply praying for the soldiers, and they are refusing to pray for the soldiers every week. I mean, it's not in other areas, too. They put on huge rallies and raise money to rescue Japanese kids in jail for smuggling drugs and other things. Did you ever hear them say anything about Gilad Shalit? Have a day of prayer for him? It's just, the mindset is just so foreign, I think, from ours. And I may say ours, I mean, I think most of the people listening. But so this is a problem from the Haredi world, how to relate to the soldiers. I remember someone pointed out something ironic. During the Gulf War, Haredi Minyanim all over were saying prayers for the soldiers of the coalition. This was Gulf War number one, I remember. And Syrian soldiers were in that coalition. So someone pointed out that they're praying for Syrian soldiers, not for Israeli soldiers. Now, during wartime, they will say Tehillim, general Tehillim. The question, though, was a special Tehillim or special prayers for the soldiers. And the sniper said yes. Normally, you don't say prayers for them. Again, for the life of me, I cannot figure out what would possibly be problematic, but we know why. They're afraid that if they do that, people will say, well, they're somehow connected to the state. But during the war, Yom Kippur War, he gave his assent to say prayers for the soldiers. But, listen, but the reason given, and this is very important, was that among the soldiers, they were also, quote, Erlich HaYidin. What does Erlich HaYidin mean? Religious Jews, pious Jews. The clear implication of this is that had the soldiers not been religious, there would be no reason to pray for them. That's his justification. This is recorded twice. He was asked this, and he said, there's Erech HaYidin, so we pray for them. How to make sense of this, a position like this, which in that circle maybe makes sense, but in the wider Haredi world, Jewish blood is Jewish blood. The idea that he's not Erech, therefore, we're not going to pray for him. That's hard to stomach. These are the sorts of things, and it's important to say this because otherwise you don't understand why, for example, Rabbi Yehuda Cook could be closest of friends with Rabbi Cheskel Sarnan, Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, and others who were definitely in the Haredi world, and the Ponevezer Rav, Rabbi Kahanemir, Rabbi Yehuda was very, you know, he was close with these rabbis. Even though he did not see eye to eye, and then when it comes to the stipler, he wants nothing to do with them. He sees the stipler as really mechutz l'machana, outside of the camp, and not someone in our camp. He sees the stipler as someone who's really undermining the sense of Klal Yisrael, just like he saw the Satmar Rav. And it's precisely this. These are recorded in the Archos Rabbeinu, both of these. So now you might say maybe this is incorrect. You can't rely on him. The problem is that these books of Archos Rabbeinu really come with Rav Chaim Kanevsky's approval, and that Rav Chaim Kanevsky is very close to the author. So I'm assuming that this is... No, that's... Bill, you're making a good joke. You know, today everyone talks about Frumkeit. I mentioned this, that Frum is good, got to be more Frum. The truth of the matter is, in Europe, Frum was a bad thing. Frumkeit, if you're, for example, in the Musar tradition, Frumkeit is bad. You don't want Frumkeit. We've spoken about this many times, and they used to say in Yiddish that a galach is frum, that is a priest, he's frum. A Jew is Erlich, a Jew is Erlich. So when he says Erlich Jews, he's not referring to the soldiers of Erlich versus the Orthodox ones. No, he's saying Erlich religious Jews, but I think maybe you're joking. What to make of things like this? And you're going to hear some more problematic things. I don't know if we need to make of it anything of it. But it's important to understand where he's coming from, if only to know why he was such a problematic figure in the religious Zionist world, in a way that the Chazon Ish wasn't, in a way that others weren't also. the slight where there was always issues that religious Zionists gedolim, although they respected his learning a great deal, from the standpoint of hashkafa, they thought it was very problematic. And they're entitled to think that, after all. We'll see what the slight thought about their hashkafa, their outlook. I will talk about the Sniper and the Zionism in a minute. What he doesn't understand is the Sniper's position regarding the state. He actually thinks the Sniper's position is correct in theory, not in practice. I'll get to that in a minute. And with such a view of the non-religious, it's understandable that he would attribute the Holocaust to the Reform Jews who were irreligious. That's why it started in Germany, although one doesn't need to be the Sniper to say this. Many have said that, including Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. That's a trope, I guess, in the Orthodox world. You attribute it to the Reform, unless you're the Eim HaBanim Smecher of Teichdal, who he attributed the Holocaust to the Orthodox. That is, the Orthodox refused to see all the signs that it was time to leave the lands of Europe and go to Eretz Yisrael, and therefore that's the onus. Now we see in this judgment that the Sniper makes that yes, pray because there's also Erlich in the army, there's religious Jews in the army, that he's not comfortable with the blanket assumption that all contemporary non-religious Jews have the status of what we call Tinok Shenishba, babes captured at when they were young. Let me explain this for a minute because it's very important. It's the it's one of the great contributions of the Chazon Ish to the wider Orthodox, non-Orthodox interaction. Basically, you have halachot in the Talmud, in the Rambam, and the other codes that describe how you're supposed to treat the irreligious. Talking about the completely irreligious and all sorts of ways you're supposed to treat them. You can't count them in minions. You can't be involved with them. If they fall into pits, you can leave them in. I mean, really enemies. And many of these things are written, obviously, in an era when being irreligious means an abandonment, a rejection of Judaism. Think back to the days of Hanukkah. I mean, to be irreligious means to be joining with the Greeks. It means to be abandoning your people. So we understand these halachot. And these halachot also kept people in the fold. You always had people who were irreligious, but they did tshuva. They were not people who were complete heretics who gave it all up. Even the irreligious people in pre-modern times assumed that come Yom Kippur, they'd have to go to shul and do tshuva. Now, that's really what Jacob Katz believes, we can identify Jewish modernity. When all of a sudden you have an ideology, you don't need to do tshuva, you don't need to repent for your sins because you don't think they're sins anymore. Jews always sinned, but they knew it was sins, and they thought they were weak. Mid-18th century in Germany, and then later in the rest of Europe, you have a new philosophy. This was an important argument he makes, and he's absolutely correct, because everyone dates Jewish modernity to the end of the 18th century in Germany. A scholar named Emanuel Schochet studied hundreds of different drashot, of the sort that Shlomo was referring to, and he publishes a whole book called Im Chilul Feit Kufot, in the Changing of an Era, in which he argued that really Jewish modernity comes in the early 1700s. Why? Because in the early 1700s, you see in the sermons, there's really a difference in kind between the rebukes that they're rebuking the people. They're rebuking them for all sorts of sins we didn't have before. I mean, you had them, but you had them occasionally. Like, just to give you one example, Rav Yonason Eibschitz. It was standard in Prague, where he was, that after, if you can believe his sermons, I mean, people don't give sermons unless it's there's a reason to speak about this. Boys and girls, after they were engaged, the parents would get them together and leave them alone. And whatever they did, they did. And that was, it was called bundling. It was a common practice among the non-Jews. There was dancing. You can read in the sermons, social dancing. I mean, these started influencing the Jewish communities. So Shochet argues that what you have here is modernity already in the early 1700s, the proof being that Jews are sinning, and Jews are breaking with convention in ways they never had before. But Katz points out that what you have here is only difference in degree, not in kind. You have more people doing sins the way they always sinned, but the mental conception of these people is the same as it always was. Come Yom Kippur, they're going to have to repent. If you would put them in the chayim or something like that, then they can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's the worst thing in the world. If you tell them they can't come to shul to say Kaddish, that's the worst thing. These people are non-observant Orthodox. non-observant or non-observant traditionalists, let's call them. That's not just a new phenomenon. These people are no different than the Sephardic populations, in which they might not be following the laws, but when they go to shul, they're going to go to the traditional shul, and they still believe in the basic values. Come the era of Mendelssohn and his students, come the beginning of the Enlightenment, the Jewish Enlightenment in Germany, there you have completely new mental conceptions. That's where you date modernity. Let me see. Glenn, let me continue talking about that. So what do you do when you have now a new phenomenon? Well, you always had these people, therefore, who were basically religious, but sinned. They were never regarded as the people, the heretics the Talmud speaks about. Then you have the heretics, like the 18th century, 19th century heretics. And then you have a new phenomenon. You have, beginning in the 19th century, really, public Sabbath violators who yet still want to be part of the community. They'll go to synagogue, and then they'll, after synagogue, they'll have Shabbos meal, say Kiddush, and they'll violate Shabbos. Now, the Talmud describes, and this is recorded in the codes, how do you know the person who really has left the community, the one that we don't have ties of brotherhood with, the Sabbath violator. However, in 19th century Germany, the Binyan Sion and Rakov Ettlinger, the first one to deal with it, and we, in our classes on Ettlinger, we spoke about this, he's confronted with a new phenomenon, the God-fearing Sabbath violator. That's what we see a lot. So he comes to us, we see that all the time today. So he develops the idea that when Chazal and the Rambam and others speak about the Sabbath violator as one, as a sign that he's not in our community, and all these terrible things are said about him, that's referring to the old Sabbath violator, who through a Sabbath violation is one step away from apostasy, he's rejected the community. However, today, when most people are Sabbath violators, that it doesn't apply anymore, they're not doing it to rebel, they're just irreligious, like they used to be irreligious, like in the olden days they used to go dancing or drink non-Jewish wine. That's the then you come to the 20th century, Rav Kook has another justification for the irreligious, because he has to explain why we can work with them. He says that their own sin, that they are forced into this. Well, how are they forced? The era, the intellectual currents, they brainwashed the people. That might be, and that was very good for the religious Zionist world. The Chazon Ish comes up with a new approach. He claims, this he says it in his commentary on Yoredeya, that contemporary irreligious have to be judged favorably. That is, we have to reach out to them. We extend ties of brotherhood. I mean, if you don't adopt this position, then you can lend money on interest to the irreligious, you don't violate Shabbos for them, all sorts of things. He says that we do not have today the open providence, the open hashgacha pratit, the, like sort of the miraculous guidance of God that they had in earlier generations. And therefore, you can't expect the irreligious, it's one thing right after you saw Nisim and Gulyam at Har Sinai, so then, you decide to go worship the golden calf. That's one thing. Or if you're living in an era with prophets. But today, it's just a different lifestyle. You don't want to be Orthodox. There's no real proof staring you in the face of why you should be. So the Chazon Ish says those sorts of people we look at differently. Basically, he's saying that all the non-religious can't be judged. They're like babes. This Tino Chinishva, because the Talmud speaks about children who were captured and grew up not knowing anything. Now, I made the point in my book on the limits of orthodoxy. As far as I know, no one has ever made this point before, and you can disagree with me. But I believe that this is much more radical for the Chazon Ish than everyone makes it out to be. The Chazon Ish is not just giving an interpretation here. He is arguing with the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, because there was not open providence in the days of the Rambam either. And yet the Rambam records all these laws. There wasn't open providence in the days of the Shulchan Aruch. What the Chazon Ish is saying is that in an era where you don't see out of the ordinary activities related to religion, miraculous type of people, therefore irreligiosity is not a sign of rejection. You just assume that someone doesn't know anything, and we can't actually convince him. There's no reason for him to assume we're right because he doesn't have the faith. That becomes the standard line in the Haredi world. It's really what it dries every kiruv and everything. Can you imagine if you're an Eishet Torah or Sameach and you tell all these people who are trying to be Makari that their parents are all evil, wicked people? I mean, that's not going to go over that well. And this becomes, everyone quotes this Chazon Ish. It becomes basic to how to relate to the irreligious in modern times. Now, Glenn, it could be that the Rav who told you about the wine was saying it either because of the Binyan Sion, was saying it because of Rav Kook, was saying it because of the Chazon Ish, there's also a position that wine is totally separate, that a Machal Shabbos doesn't make wine treif no matter what, because what's the reason? We're concerned, now we don't really have Yain Nesach anymore, we're concerned that the non-Jews, their wine, we're going to marry their daughters, but you can marry a non-Shomer Shabbos person's daughter. So some hold that Bechal, a non-religious person, you don't have to be concerned about the wine to begin with. So there's lots of reasons why the wine is not an issue. Yes, he says that, if I'm not mistaken, Ovadia, he says it in both places. He says it in two separate places in his commentary on Yoredeya. It's the same idea. It's the same lowering into a pit. The whole thing, it's all the same. Now, the Stipler, as we know, would never claim to disagree with the position of the Chazon Ish. That's the last thing. If you read not just what he writes, what's written about him, his whole life was based upon the Chazon Ish. As I said already last class, or the class before, if the Chazon Ish didn't hold of a certain Chumrah, then there's no reason to hold of this Chumrah. And if the Chazon Ish said to do something, even if it appears strange or different, you do it. In other words, he was a mirror image. Anything the Chazon Ish said to him was literally like the breastplate, the Urim the Tumim. That's Ovadia. That the first one to say this is the Binyan Sion, the famous tshuva. It's in the Chelot Beis number 23. And what's interesting about this tshuva is that this was published after his death by his son. And the son, right at the beginning of that section, says that these tshuvot are halacha v'lo l'masa. That is, they're not for practice. They're just theoretical halachot. And yet, despite that, this becomes accepted in practice, becomes a standard. This becomes the standard responsa. And you had the same phenomenon in America. Why do you think you had Shabbos morning davening in places like the Lower East Side at 6:30 in the morning? So they're done by 8:30 and they go to work. These were what I term the God-fearing Sabbath violators. And in our classes on Rav Chaim Hirschenson, he deals with this at length. You know, how to relate to these people they were good Jews even. They felt that they had to work. Chaim Hirschenson wasn't even referring to the ones who don't know any better, they don't think it's such a big deal, you know, the typical Sephardic, Machal Shabbos, he thinks, well, that's just for the super religious, we're also religious, just not so religious, and since we're not so religious, we can drive on Shabbos. I mean, I was at a Sephardic shul, I'm not going to say where, but the people coming to shul Shabbos morning, and my father was with me, it was very interesting, they're not even parking like two blocks away around the corner. Like when I was growing up, when they used to come to shul, they used to park around the corner. They were parking mamish right in front of the shul. Not embarrassed at all. And by the way, Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach says, if you're Machal Shabbos before Hesya, even in a place like Borough Park, and if the rabbi is walking down the street, and rather than hiding because you're embarrassed, if you're embarrassed because of that, when you see the rabbi, it doesn't matter if everyone else sees you, you're not a Machal Shabbos of Parhesia. And also others have said that if you know so little that when the rabbi walks down the street, you wave to him and say good Shabbos, even though you're being Machal Shabbos, you're also not a Machal Shabbos. So the only person who is a Machal Shabbos is the one who's not embarrassed when the rabbi comes down and is Lahachis. That is, wants the rabbi to see him because he wants the rabbi to know he doesn't care about Shabbos. Now, how many of these people are there in the world? Very, very few. Wow. Bill, so you're saying more of what happens attributed to science. Well, obviously, but I'm not sure what that's, what's the relevance of that to. Please clarify. That is one of the great manifestations of modernity as well. God is pushed further and further away. It used to be that everything that happened, I mean, we all know about eclipses, but everything that happened, the weather, this is all attributed to God. Now, those of us on the East Coast know that Sunday afternoon it looked wonderful, and yet if you're listening to the news, they told you that snow was coming. So we've pushed God further and further away. Yeah, but I don't know if that's still, if when you say it's different than in the Rambam's time, I don't know if that's what the Chazon Ish is referring to. He speaks about open providence. I think open providence means sort of like in prophetic times. The problem with that means that his position would even apply in the Rambam's day as well. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to make of it. The Rambam, though, he also saw the world as functioning according to nature, but the average people didn't. Now, as I said, the Stipor would not be seen to disagree with the Chazon Ish. So that means for the Stipor to come up with a different position than the Chazon Ish, he has to reinterpret him. Reinterpretation happens all the time. We all reinterpret. There's a difference between authentic reinterpretation and inauthentic. Authentic reinterpretation is when it develops organically, naturally, when you believe that this is an authentic understanding. And obviously, the Stipor believes that. However, that doesn't mean that everyone else needs to believe it. Inauthentic interpretation is when you put forth an argument you know is incorrect, is not in line with the person who you're interpreting, but you want to advocate a position. We assume that when we're having arguments with a lot of authorities on, let's say, what Rav Moshe Feinstein meant or Rabbi Soloveitchik, that, at least I assume, that both the Saul Bermans of the world and the Herschel Schachters, that they are both authentic interpreters. That they think one could be wrong, and we could attempt to prove one is wrong. In some cases, we could even show one is wrong. However, I assume that they're all authentic interpreters, even if their interpretations are incorrect, because I take them to be, to use that word, Ehrlich. I grant that people on the right don't assume that about people on the left. They assume that they are inauthentic and that they are just using Rabbi Soloveitchik to advance an agenda. And by the same token, people on the left assume that about people on the right. And in some cases, the interpretation is so egregious, egregiously wrong, on both the left and on the right. On the left, going as far as Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, and on the right, people like Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, the interpretations are so egregious that it really strains credulity to assume that these are authentic interpretations. But even those, I at least am prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt. So this Stipor offers an interpretation. His interpretation is that the Chazon Ish's liberal position about the non-religious, a position which for a good 20, 25 years was the standard position in the Haredi world, was only referring to the non-religious who were raised this way, but not to those who had some knowledge of God and Torah. Now, the Chazon Ish doesn't say that. The Stipor says, and he was not interpreted this way. You can see plenty of Haredi writers writing about the Chazon Ish's position, and none of them ever interpret the Chazon Ish this way. Now, the Chazon Ish's position was not absolute. He still recognized the category of heretic. I'm assuming he thought Ben-Gurion was a heretic. I mean, there are still people who are intent on uprooting religion, who even in the Chazon Ish's mind would have to be regarded as a heretic, if only because that they are uprooting religion. If they were private citizens, presumably they would not fall into that category. So the Chazon Ish still will have people who are heretics, people who grow up, let's say, in the Orthodox world, who then become anti-religious, a person like Chaim Grada, who we mentioned, although the Chazon Ish loved him, I think the Chazon Ish, or maybe the Chazon Ish wouldn't, but I mean, you could see the Chazon Ish might have to conclude that he is an example, he's a great Talmud Chacham, Chaim Grada, who decides to give it up, maybe he falls into that category, but not the average person, and that's the whole point of the Chazon Ish's position. But the Stipor says no. The Stipor says that the Chazon Ish is only referring to a tinuk shenishba, a babe captured, that is one who grows up completely indoctrinated. You grow up with communist parents. You grow up in assimilated France or America. But if you grew up with some religiosity, some knowledge of God and Torah, so what does that mean? There's the rub. What does that mean, knowledge of God and Torah? The Stipor is quoted by his grandson in the biography as saying that as long as you attended cheder, that meant that you were not among the ones that the Chazon Ish absolved from this category of evildoer, category of not part of our community, that is heretic, apikoros, with all the negative connotations. That's what he says. That's what the Stipor is quoted as saying. It is very difficult to see this I mean, in the Chazon Ish, and no one ever said it, as far as I know, before the Sipur. And they said just the opposite. And we're talking about people who were followers of the Chazon Ish. If you just had a cheder education, you finished cheder at 12, 13. That's, and then you went off, and then you got involved with the Bund or Zionism or anything. That's an education? Every single person in America who goes to yeshiva day school, yeshiva high school, gets a better education than 99% of the Jews in Eastern Europe. We study Torah much longer. Most East European Jews were completely ignorant. They had no knowledge. They didn't learn Gemara. Today we have Baal Baptim. They go every morning. They learn Daf Yomi. They learn other things. The average person, if you go to Chevra, if he's lucky, he goes to Chevra Mishnayos. He goes to Yaakov. He goes to Chevra Tehillim. Who learned Gemara? The elites. And you're going to say that because these ignoramuses, that they got just a few years in cheder, that they fall into that category? It's very hard. This point I just made about them being completely ignorant, so sometimes people wonder, well, why do we need all this day school education? Why do we have to send kids to high school? Look in Europe. They didn't get much education. They kept their communities. They still, Orthodoxy was able to hold its own. Well, truthfully, that's not true. Orthodoxy wasn't really holding its own. Eastern Europe, within the space of two generations, it lost enormous amounts in the big cities, the majority non-Orthodox, and had it gone on this way, it would have ended up just no different than Germany. Also, we have to know the differences today when everyone gets a secular education, and we can't have a situation where people have advanced high school educations, they go to college, and give them grade school Judaism. I mean, in Eastern Europe, before the war, you didn't get much secular education, if anything, so we can give you a sixth grade level Jewish. But if you can't give people sixth grade level Judaism, or seventh grade level, if you're giving them high school, college secular studies. Now, this attitude of the Sipur which I just mentioned, had all sorts of practical implications. One of the practical implications was what I just mentioned about the soldiers. Unlike other great rabbis who were very welcoming to the non-observant, the rule in the Sipur's house, just to give you one example, if you want to see, there's five volumes of the practices of the Sipur, and you can see how this plays out. But just one example. The rule in his house was that one who was not Torah observant could not receive his blessing. Other rabbis bless anyone who comes to them. They speak to anyone who comes to them. They want. In the Sipur, he only wanted to have dealings with religious Jews. And if you know some of the stories, he had a bit of a temper. He chased people out. If he thought they were talking to Narishkeit, he would literally chase them out of his home. He only wanted to have relationships with religious Jews. And so begins a trend that has picked up steam, and I'll talk more about that today in next class, in the Haredi world, in some parts of the Haredi world, where they don't want anything to do with the outside world. And you can have a society like Bnei Brak, where you only have not just religious Jews, only have Haredi Jews, and that's your whole life live with them. You never had Jews like that in Europe. In Europe, everyone lives together. You have in Canada, you have with Tush, and you have Kiryas Yoel and places like that. We see, therefore, that what was viewed as an incredible advance by the Chazon Ish, in terms of Orthodox and non-Orthodox relations, because remember, for the Haredi community, especially the newly forming Haredi community, you can't quote to them Rav Kook. You don't even want to quote them the Binyan Tzion, certainly not Rav Chaim Hirschenson, but Chazon Ish gives you the imprimatur to revise the way you used to relate to the irreligious. Now you can relate to them in ties of brotherhood. That opens up all sorts of possibilities. And that was viewed as an incredible advance. The Sipur undermines it, not by rejecting the Chazon Ish, but by severely limiting its applicability. The Sipur does not claim to have ever discussed this with the Chazon Ish. Rather, his knowledge is based on his intimate understanding of the Chazon Ish's worldview. So that, in and of itself, requires everyone to give a great deal of credence. The Sipur knew the Chazon Ish as well as anyone. Could be he knew him better than anyone else. At the very least, he knew him as well as many. As well as, I mean, as well as a few others, if not knowing the best. So, under normal circumstances, I would say his understanding gets pride of place. On the other hand, we also have to say that there were those who knew the Chazon Ish very well, who consulted with him all the time. People would go and consult the Chazon Ish all the time. They got a different message from the Chazon Ish. It's a story we see all too often. I mean, they are students of Roy Soloveitchik, very close students, and yet certain things they say are disputed by others who also knew Rabbi Soloveitchik well, Rabbi Chiyakov Weinberg. I mean, there were people who knew Rabbi Weinberg well, very well, who actually thought that his letters to Samuel Atlas were inauthentic. He couldn't have wrote it. One person thought it was a forgery. I don't know how well this person knew him, but he knew him from his books. So we assume if we know people, even children sometimes, the disciple is a brother-in-law, children sometimes think that they have a veto over how the parent should be portrayed because children do know the parents often best. And it's not always the case, though. Sometimes children see one aspect. The Stipler saw one aspect. I mean, Rav Aaron Kahn, let's bring it to modern days, YU, for him to say, I mean, he was a close student of Roy Soloveitchik, a great follower, who saw him in Shir. So for Rav Aaron Kahn to say that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't value secular studies because I never saw him with a secular book, I mean, it's nonsense. Had he lived in the Rabbi Soloveitchik's house, he would have seen plenty of secular books. But when he went back to the apartment in the Heights, he never saw the secular books. So this is a common thing that people assume, and I think that's how that because they were so close that they can speak for them. And I think here we have an example, if you're going to say, how can people continue to quote the Chazon Ish, even in the Haredi world, when the Stipler is given a different interpretation? I think one answer is that the Stipler does not have exclusive rights over the Chazon Ish. The Stipler needs, his position needs to be taken very seriously, everything he says, but he doesn't have exclusive rights. No one has exclusive rights. Rav Heschel Schachter doesn't have exclusive rights over Rabbi Soloveitchik either. Even Rav Aaron Lichtenstein doesn't have exclusive rights. Rabbi Tenler, Rabbi David Feinstein, look, the debate we're having right now about brain death. Certainly Roy Tendler, no one says he has exclusive rights over Moshe Feinstein, but Rav David Feinstein. Rav David Feinstein, you can see him on tape testifying if there's no respiration. Rav Moshe held, and he says it's not even a question. Rav Moshe always held this. This is what he did in Europe. If there's no respiration, then the person is regarded as dead. And if you're brain dead, there's no respiration. And just look at the RCA document. They reject Rav David Feinstein's statement. Who was closer to Rav Moshe Feinstein or Rav David Feinstein? No one in the world was closer to Rav Moshe Feinstein or Rav David Feinstein. He was literally at his side all the time. And Rav David Feinstein is telling you that my father holds respiration as the only sign for life. And if that's the only sign, then you can use brain death. And yet, not only the RCA report, other people refuse to accept Rav David Feinstein also. So, and I'm not saying, that's okay. You can accept if you can prove to your satisfaction that maybe Rav David Feinstein doesn't have all the facts, that another Shiva says differently. All you can say, I think, is that Rav David Feinstein gets strong consideration, overwhelming consideration, I would even say, but not absolute. And why do I say not absolute? Because we have examples where even children, even the closest of students, were wrong. They thought their father held a position that turned out they were wrong. Have it with Ravad Yosef and his sons. Remember I gave you the example about can Ashkenazi become a Sephardi in Israel? Any kidneys? I read this to you. I should put this on the Sfarim blog. And I have two letters. One from Rav Yitzhak Yosef saying absolutely not. Only a Baal Tshuva can do that. A regular Ashkenazi, even though he's in the land of Israel, has to still observe kidneys. And Rav Avram Yosef, the other son, the chief Rav Echolon, another great scholar, early son of Rav Yosef, says no. If you're an Ashkenazi in the land of Israel, you can become a Sfardi. That means, as I said, you take the good and the bad. You have to, you can eat kidneys, but you have to eat clock kosher and everything. I mean, you have to be a complete Sfardi. But you can, I don't know what the word would be. Is there a word? He's afraid or something? You can turn yourself into a Sfardi. And we spoke in great detail about this. So here you have a case where one of Rav Avadya's sons is wrong. And we have other cases about what bracha to make on Bamba. I mean, each one's saying differently. So that's my point. I say this only because the Chazon Ish, if you read what he says in Yoreh Deah, he doesn't say what the Slifer says he says. If you look at the students and the others who write about the Chazon Ish, none of them mention that he's only referring to people who had no Jewish education. And yet you have the Slifer saying differently. So I don't think the Slifer's position now means that the traditionally understood Chazon Ish view, which is a welcoming, open view, has now been rendered out of bounds. And I don't think you can say, well, the Slifer has a veto, in my opinion. Yes, you say, and I think, Ovadia, when Yitzhak Yosef appeared, or Yitzhak Yosef with the Moshe Sternbach, and out of his mouth came a statement that his father actually holds that these conversions are only conversions of the Israeli soldiers, so that if they get married, they can't get, if they're married, they have to get a get. That's not what his father said. His father never said that. Rav Amar never said that. Here you have a case of where I think in trying to make Shalom peace, Rav Yitzhak Yosef extrapolated. And in the clarification by Rav Avad Yosef, he never said that either. All he said was what his position always was. And Rav Avad has, I believe, been totally consistent. I don't think there's been any backtracking here. That unless you know for certain, or at least the Beis Din, it's muchach to the Beis Din, there's a clear assumption that the person in front of them is a fraud, then it's a valid conversion. And if right after the conversion, the person then is not religious, he contradicts himself one time, but all the rest of his writings, he says this. If you do the conversion, and there was no reason at the time to assume it was a fake, if you see later the person's not religious, this person is now a sinning Jew. That's what he holds. And in the clarification issue, he said the same thing, that it has to be that the person is serious. And how do you know if they're serious? Because the Beis Din tells you they're serious. If a Beis Din of Talmidei Chachamim investigates these people and say that they're accepting Judaism, and then it turns out later they're not religious, well, then these are sinning Jews. That's Rav Avadia's position. And it hasn't changed at all. So you ask a question, Barak, why not ask Rav Avad Yosef? They were having this argument, and this was in all the Israeli newspapers. Is it Mazonos or is it Shaka? Why not just ask him? The problem was both of them claimed to have asked him. So why not both go together at the same time and ask him? I don't know the answer to that. It's a very good question. The fact is they don't get along that well, the two sons. But you're right. We should never have arguments like this when it can be clarified very simply. Lehit tafreid. That's to become Sephardi. Okay. Let's move on. So with his visceral dislike of the state and what it stood for, which we mentioned already, nevertheless, the Slifer did not go to the extreme of shunning any involvement with the government. You might have thought that if he felt this so extreme, he'll just become like Sadler. Missouri Carter want nothing to do with the government. Not at all. Pragmatic self-interest dictated that the Haredim elect representatives to the Knesset. This is exactly what they did in Poland. You did it in Poland, you do it in Israel. The fact that you're in the Knesset doesn't mean that you're a Zionist, that you've accepted Herzl's vision. You are citizens of the State of Israel. The laws of the State of Israel affect you. The State of Israel gives you the right to put people in parliament. You can influence the state in accordance with not just your self-interest, but also you can try to bring Jewish Torah observance and things to other parts of the state, because even if you regard these people as heretics, you still want that they not be heretics and become observant, and therefore the Slifer thought that it was vital, not just vital, requirement to vote and to send people to the Knesset. He said, this is the tradition we have from our great rabbis, meaning the Lithuanian rabbis who authorized, not just in Europe, sending Jews to parliament, but from the moment the state was established, the Agudas Yisrael sent members. In fact, in the first government of Agudas Yisrael, and only in the first government, there was an Aguda figure, Itzhamer Levin, who was an actual, he held a cabinet post, and he signed the Declaration of Independence. Subsequent to that, no Aguda deputy has ever held a cabinet post. So even, I think, the health department now, Netanyahu, correct me if I'm wrong, he's actually the Minister of Health, but it's run by this guy, the Aguda deputy, who has the position of Deputy Minister of Health. There, for theological reasons, they don't want to be ideological reasons, they don't want to actually be in the cabinet. Shas had no problem with this. And when I say Aguda, I also mean Devil Torah. Shas had no problem. As soon as they got their representatives, they'll be Minister of Interior, they'll be all the ministers. They don't have this 100-year-old battle with Zionism that, they have a problem then being a member of the cabinet. So the Steinberg continuously urges followers, and you can see numerous such appeals in his collected letters, to vote in the various elections. He sees this as nothing less than a holy task. It's a chiyuv, it's an obligation. Now, what did he mean when you read these letters from the 60s and the 70s? He's saying to vote. He says for the most religious party. That's what, sometimes he actually says, vote for Aguda, vote for this line. But other times he simply says, vote for the most religious party. There were times that in local elections, the city elections, he might not have thought that Aguda was the most religious. He might have had like another Haredi party, which is, he thought was more religious. In the national scene, no, it was the Aguda. This is an obligation. In addition to the electoral obligation to vote for the most pious party, the Steinberg goes further. He actually states that it is forbidden to vote for any other party. That is, you were obligated to vote for Agudas Yisrael or whatever party takes the place of Agudas Yisrael. Why is it forbidden to vote for, let's say, Mafdal or Likud or Labor or anything like that? Because to do so is to identify with those who want to destroy the foundations of Torah. Now, we understand how that would apply to Likud and Labor, but even Mafdal, even National Religious Party, as we'll see soon, all these parties have as part of their platforms undermining of Torah values, that is Haredi Torah values, and therefore it is forbidden to vote for them. So the political and the religious were completely merged in his mind, just like Ratzvi Yehuda. Remember what Ratzvi Yehuda said, that the politics, the politica of the Jewish people is Torah. The Steinberg agrees with that exact statement. The politics of the Jewish people are Torah. Of course, their conclusions are exact opposite. For Ratzvi Yehuda, that means that you must vote, and he says you must vote for the National Religious Party. You can't vote for any of the other parties, because only the National Religious Party will hold on to Yehuda and Shomron, and only the National Religious Party will put forth Eretz Yisrael HaShlema education. And the Steinberg says the same thing. You must. The politics of the Jewish people is Torah, and therefore you must vote for the Haredi Party. You might assume that, hey, every person, you know, this is very American, we should assume on their own which party will best represent them. We might see the Steinberg's position as, I don't know, overreach or even abhorrent, the notion that a religious figure can command his followers whom to vote for. Yet this is entirely expected in the Haredi world. And the politicians know this very well. When Hillary Clinton or everyone else, when they go to New Square, or when they all come during election season to visit, to put on those yarmulkes, some of them look like the yarmulkes belong there, others look very uncomfortable in them. When they go to visit the various Satmar Ravs, or they go to visit this rabbi or that rabbi, they're doing it because they know that these rabbis can deliver. If the Satmar Rav endorses a candidate, he's going to pull 90% of his people with him. And that's huge blocks. We know now that Haredi are not the same blocks that people used to think they are. I mean, you can look at B'nai Brak, for example, and you see you have people voting for all sorts of parties. So, but still, they can pull maybe not 90%, maybe 80%. That is, you have Haredi who on their own, Kach, Mergana used to get a high percentage in B'nai Brak. But you can still pull a great deal of votes from the Haredi bloc. And as I said, this is expected in the Haredi world. I see it's already just about 10, so let us stop here. For next class, we're going to continue with this. We have some more of the politics to talk about and how he differs from the Satmar Rav. We'll see that he actually thinks the Satmar Rav is right in theory, which is a break from the Haredi world, most of the Haredi world, but wrong in practice. And then we will talk about some of his letters. He has such amazing letters that we could spend 3 or 4 weeks on them, but we'll just spend maybe a good half hour on some very interesting material. I will stop here at 10 o'clock and or 1 minute to 10. And if there are questions or comments, just a second, I have something I'm going to show you. I don't see it now. I'll show you next class. So let's, if there's questions or comments, we actually have about 37 or 36 signed up this semester, so the word is getting around. Also, everyone should look for the ad this week for the trip in the Jewish Press. I think the Jewish Week will be the next week. This week is the Jewish Press. We're hoping to get Schneer Lyman for his tours, maybe J.J. Schachter pulled in from people who read the Jewish Press, so we hope that'll be quite successful. Please spread the word. If you have friends or parents or relatives who want to come to on our trip, it's make it or break it. We're trying, working very hard now to get to our magic number. Someone is emailing me privately when I mentioned that about Frum, how in Europe Frum was a negative thing. He emails me that Frum was an acronym of Theorishus, a lot of wickedness, and Venig Mitzvos, and not so many Mitzvos. I haven't heard that one. That's a very good one. In fact, I'm going to write that down. In Europe, when you spoke about Frum, it was someone trying to be an upstart, trying to be, you know, wear his religion on his sleeve. Today, it doesn't mean that, though. Today, I don't think it has that connotation. Shlomo says, and I'm reading them out loud now, because people who listen, not live, they've asked me to repeat the questions. Otherwise, sometimes they don't know what we're talking about. So, Shlomo says, there's a story of Chaim Shmulevitz visiting his uncle Rav Yochanan and being pointed out the stipler as the next gadol. Okay, well, I mean, it could be not. Many people were pointed out as the next gadol, and most of them never became the next gadol. So probably everyone who did become the next gadol was pointed out. I don't know why that's significant, because many people were said. You can read the literature, the writings, and there's plenty of people who are, you know, they publish when they're young in these Torah journals, and they're called the Eloi, the great this and that, and no one ever hears of them again. I never heard Rav Galinsky's hesped on the stipler, and I don't know who Rav Galinsky is, so you can enlighten me. I mean, I heard of him, but I don't really know who he is. Any other comments or questions? Okay, I'll wait one more minute in case someone is writing. You can see the background here. I'm in Scranton, not at home. Apparently the reception is better when I'm in Scranton. The stipler had, let's see, how many daughters does the stipler have? He had, well, obviously he has one son, Rav Chaim Kanievsky. There's another, does he have another son? You know, I don't know how many children he has. I don't know. Two daughters. Okay, is it one son, Shlomo? Only one son? It's very easy. You pull up Wikipedia, you'll get the Hebrew Wikipedia, you'll get all the answers. You say it's two daughters, but only one son, I think. I will speak a little bit later at the very end, the next class, about Rav Chaim Kanievsky, because Rav Chaim Kanievsky is one of those children, many children take over from their fathers, and the children really are not at the father's level. But since they had the good yichus, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, even without his father, would have been such a leader. I mean, he is himself unique in so many ways, and he has qualities that his father doesn't have in terms of incredible knowledge of all sorts of things. His father really focused. His father's library is very small if you read his books. Rav Chaim Kanievsky has enormous, enormous knowledge. I mean, it's really it's hard to even imagine one person having that sort of knowledge. Someone emails that when I started tonight with opening the refrigerator on Shabbos, and he said, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wondered if you could open without your eyes closed. The problem is how to close it. Originally, Rav Shlomo Zalman thought that you could just unplug it, you know, if you needed to get in. Now, the problem is that, and that apparently would work, because then the lights would not be on, but, you know, if you see it, if it's not, let's say, the motor's not working, that might be a hector. It's a problem. What do you do if you have the light on in it? How do you close it? Well, the question is, I think some might say you don't need to close it. But if you need the food, there's ways you can close it. You can close with a shinoi, you know, you get a non-Jew to close it. I don't know. It's Rav Mazuz thinks, and Rav Yosef, you get a katan who hasn't, not at the age of chinuch. You get a three-year-old, a four-year-old kid or something, and they can close it. That's what you would do. The question is, can they open it? It's too heavy for them. I don't know if they'd be able to open it. And I'm sure you have different opinions. One son, okay. Did the Sipher comment on Ladavish? No, he did not. The great, at least privately he might have, but in his writings, and even in the five volumes of his table talk, you don't have anything about Lubavitch. The feud about Lubavitch really gets going in the 1980s. He's still around, but we don't see anything of him. It's really Rav Shach takes the lead on this. My assumption is, and this, that his view of Lubavitch is the same as Rav Shach and the Briskerov, and I'm sure if you look hard enough, you'll find somewhere where he says something about Lubavitch. For him, Lubavitch would be just another sort of reform type of reform of Judaism. Not that he's a Reform Jews, even he wouldn't say that, Chas v'Shalom, but that this is a reform of Judaism. For the same reasons we'll see, he opposes Mizrahi and all that. You know, this is not the tradition. Okay, and someone emails privately that Rav Chaim Kanievsky visits his sister often. Rav Chaim Kanievsky's wife is a very important woman in the Haredi world. She's a spiritual leader. Neil asks, is it true that the Nevardic Yeshiva used the Stiper as an example, that it was not just the Musar Yeshiva, but it also produced great scholars? If they didn't do that, then they'd be very foolish. I began, the beginning of the first, talking about the Stiper, saying that although the Nevardic Yeshiva had the reputation of not producing great Torah scholars, that is false, and the greatest proof of that is the Stiper, that you can produce great Torah scholars from Nevardic, and that all these things they used to do were in addition, although I also don't think you could make the case that that Nevardic produced it despite what they were doing. If you compare the great scholars that came out of Slobodka, I mean, you're talking not just five or ten, you're talking tens and tens, or out of Mir, and you compare it came out of Nevardic, you really can't compare the two. The other, Nevardic is not producing the same sort of scholars. This is an anomaly, the Spiper and a couple others. Look at Slobodka. That's the major leagues. Look at Mir, even Tells. I mean, that's really where the great ones are coming out of. I mean, the Chazon Ish held, I don't know per se what the Chazon Ish held about Chabad. You're asking, I've never heard anything. I know what the Brisker Rav held about Chabad. The Chazon Ish was alive during the previous Rebbe. And there were great feuds between the Misnagdim and the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. This, even in Shanghai, there were disputes about how to, between Ravar and Cutler, you know, what to do with the money, should it go to Chabad or not. So there always were feuds between Chabad. From the early 20th century, Chabad always went their own way. They refused to be involved with the Haredi world, with the Orthodox world, and all sorts of things. But in terms, when we speak about Rav Shach's opposition to Chabad, we're talking about really theological reasons, and ideological reasons, not just because Chabad annoyed them, because Chabad would only be concerned about themselves. We're talking about messianism. That's very different than what the Chazon Ish would have said. The Brisker Rav, however, he was alive when Rav Nachum Mendel gave his famous drasha, when he he comes into office, I guess you'd call it that, and the Brisker Rav is quoted as saying, the Meshuggah thinks he's Mashiach. So, you see already from the Brisker Rav negativity towards the Rav Nachum Mendel, but it's only in the 1980s when the messianism gets going and Rav Shach decides to take the lead that it really becomes a real war. Milchama leads to the breaking up of Agudas Yisrael to a certain extent. Those in Toronto know that Rabbi Shlomo Miller was opposed to Chabad before it was fashionable. But again, you have to distinguish between opposing Chabad for the old reasons, that Chabad likes to do its own thing, they don't want to be involved with the general Orthodox community, and opposing Chabad because of what you believe to be its false messianism, its heresy perhaps, its false doctrines. I mean, you can oppose Chabad for sociological reasons, for political reasons, and then you can oppose it for theological reasons. The opposition of Rav Shach and Rav Shlomo Miller and others is really for theological reasons, that this is a new type of Judaism. You've all heard the joke made that Chabad is the closest religion to Judaism. So those who are interested, listen to my talks on Rav Shach. We deal with it in great length. At the same time that Rav Shach was saying this, though, you had other Lithuanian rabbis who were very close to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and didn't see this as so problematic. So, Ovadia, I do not. Ovadia says that in the old edition of Igros, the Chazon Ish has a letter saying that their wine is yein nesach or is later taken out. You need to prove this to me, Ovadia, because first of all, I don't believe that anything in the old letters were taken out. If that's true, I want to know about it because I'm working hard at a book on censorship, and I do not believe that there is anything in the old letters that were taken out. Second, the tradition of a certain Hasidic group that their wine is yein nesach, that is stated about the Breslovers. I've never heard it said about Chabad. I am shocked that it would be said about Chabad. Rav Yoshev actually was asked about this, as the Tshuvas was asked about this, and it's about the Breslovers. And I haven't seen the Tshuva, but Rav Chaim Rappaport told me it's in it. And he says that the Chayram still applies to the Breslovers. He was asked, does the Chayram against the Hasidim apply to any group? And he says, only the Breslovers. So, yes, if you can get a copy of it, email it to me. That's important not just for my general knowledge or for the book I'm writing, but you have references to a certain Hasidic group, then wine, Yei Nesach, and everything like that. That has always been understood, what I've seen, as referring to the Breslovers, that they are sort of out of the fold. But please enlighten me this semester especially. I have very learned people, and you know, comments both here and in emails you sent to me, and you all know what it says, what the rabbis tell us, that, let me say it again, I've said it in previous times, that you learn a lot from your teacher, you learn, you know, then you learn more from your colleagues, you learn most from your students, and here, sitting in the University of Scranton, with typical American students, this never applied to me, and the passage of Chazal didn't apply to me. I never learned anything from my students. How could I learn anything? They don't know anything. But students like you guys teach me a lot. The Chazal's teaching is really comes to fruition. Glenn, someone asked me, what's my view of Rav Yaakov Weinberg of Nei Yisrael? Another time we can get into that. I don't want to go into it in great detail now. Also a very interesting figure, but it would take us too far afield. Bill, there may be censorship where the cipher quoted the Chazon Ish differently than normally reported. I don't know. It could be that this is a problem. We have books written by people about the Stipler. How much is it reliable? It's a problem. I don't know. I am assuming that Chaim Kanievsky and that whole school there, that they're presenting the authentic position. It could be not. It could be, but, you know, until you can prove otherwise, we're stuck. The person who emailed me, Rav Yaakov Weinberg, we will eventually get to deal with the American Torah scene. We'll deal with Nei Yisrael. He didn't have much of an influence with Rav Yaakov Weinberg. He died, unfortunately, young, but he was really a continuation of that Rav Ruderman model of trying to build up a Haredi community, which is not extremist, which people can make a living, they can be professionals, and they were very successful in Baltimore, and that's a model that you know, is really, can go on. Okay, well then no one else is emailing in. If there's anything else you want to say, you don't want to say it here, if we hang up, send it to me privately and I'll try to, get to it when we begin the class. We probably will have one entire class left, maybe not, but perhaps one more on the Stipler, and then we move on, to the Chasam Sofer.